Welcome back to Following Know It on a Stormlight podcast. This week is our Wind and Truth preview chapters number 6. We are in chapters 10 and 11. David, how are you?
I'm doing well. Busy as usual, but nice to take some time to read some Sanderson and talk about it.
Yeah. Tim?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to jump in. We keep on getting answers and it's confusing, but I'll take
it. Yeah, the answers do keep coming, but they come with more questions that I did not think I'd be asking. So let's roll intro and then we'll get to our epigrams. Any volunteers for the epigraphs?
I'll read them. Should I read epigraph 9 also, just to because it seems to flow into 10?
Yeah. Frame it with some context. That'd be nice.
So I'll start with chapter 9 then. All agree the first key moment came when Kaladin Stormblessed listened. Though not an edge dancer, he did a fine impression of their oaths. Chapter 10. The second moment had happened already, when Zeth himself decided to take upon him this quest, the one that would shape all of our futures. Chapter 11. For while the contest of champions was to happen in the east, a different contest was to happen in Shinovar, and one that the wind swore was equally vital, perhaps more so.
I'm going to save author speculations till last, but what... Refresh my memory. I need even more context, I guess. What's the key moment? Are we talking about the wind, like, talking? Is that still what our key moments are framed around?
I believe so.
It's a bit of a leap, because the previous chapter is talking about the wind, you know, having fanciful memory, but this time she's deliberate, concern-focused, that sort of thing. So, like, I feel like it's starting a new paragraph almost, and we don't really have context for like what we're talking about in terms of key moment.
Because I mean, the epigraph from chapter 9 makes sense to me. The first key moment came when Kaladin Stormblessed listened. The second moment happened already when Zeth himself decided to take upon the quest. What does Zeth have to do with the wind?
Well, I think they're talking about Zeth's fourth ideal mission to cleanse Shinovar.
Right.
So yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with the wind. It's like a key moment of the events that we're about to read about.
Okay.
Yeah, because chapter 11 is basically saying, yeah, Contest of Champions is important, but perhaps what's happening in Shinovar was even more important.
Right.
So that would be Kaladin and Zeth doing whatever they're going to do there with Ishar and the Unmade and all that jazz.
I'm even more curious about who's writing this and who wins, because if you're diminishing the importance of the Contest of Champions, I'm really curious who that's coming from and what the outcome is. Because if Odium wins, that seems to be like a really big deal. But if what's happening in Shinovar is equal to that, then what's the outcome of the Contest of Champions, and what exactly is going on in Shinovar? I haven't given it that much weight by any means.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's too much of a surprise that Kaladin's mission is going to be important to the plot, but I've been suspicious of Shinovar from the start, right? Like, there's just something going on with Shinovar. They have their religion and their, you know, like, even really early on, Zeth was talking about, like, if he were to, you know, die, then the shamans would come and retrieve the honor blade, and that they have a bunch of the honor blades, and like, what's going on over there is really the question. And why aren't they helping in the battle against Odium? They have all the honor blades. So like, something's going on and we don't know what it is, but Odium probably had some kind of thing in place to neutralize Shinovar before even summoning the Everstorm, because they would be a huge threat.
Definitely. I'm with you there. And honestly, thinking about the Contest of Champions, remind me, or correct me if I'm wrong, but if they lose, the only thing that happens is Dalinar goes to serve Odium, right? That's the only bad thing. Now, that's really bad.
Well, but doesn't Odium get let out of his Roshar bottle?
So the deal is basically a win-win for Roshar because Odium's not actually released, as far as I know. We could go back to Rhythm of War and like look over the terms, but my memory is that like basically Odium's like, look, this is really good for you. The only difference is whether you join me or not. Is my memory as well, Tim. So it's kind of a weird thing that's happening in the first place if it's really all about Dalinar.
So maybe the author's right. Maybe the contest doesn't actually matter that much.
Yeah, maybe.
Why did I think that Odium got out of Roshar?
I'll check the copper mine real quick just to make sure we have all the right information.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at right now. Okay, so the initial terms is that if Odium wins, then all Roshar would be his. If he loses, then they would have to withdraw from the planet for millennium. He refuses, counters, says if he wins, or if Dalinar wins, Odium will go to Braze for 1,000 years and stop contacting the Fused or Voidspren. But if he wins, then they will abandon Roshar. He will abandon Roshar and free the Singers to make their own peace with the Coalition of Monarchs.
We have the final terms here.
Okay.
The final terms are these. A contest of champions to the death. On the 10th day of the month of Pala, 10th hour, we each send a willing champion, allowed to meet at the top of Urethiru, otherwise unharmed by either side's forces. If I win that contest, you will remain bound to the system, but you will return Alethkar and Herdaz to me, with all of their occupants intact. You will vow to cease hostilities and maintain the peace, not working against my allies or my kingdoms in any way. Agreed, Odium said. But if I win, I keep everything I've won, including your homeland. I still remain bound to the system, and I will still cease hostilities, as you said above. But I will have your soul to serve me, immortal. Will you do this? Because I agree to these terms. And then Dalinar agrees as well. So there is more to it because it has to do with Alethkar and Herdaz control. Right. In addition to Dalinar's soul.
Interesting.
But he remains bound regardless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And hostilities will cease regardless. So.
Yeah, and I think the reason it's presented as a win-win for our heroes, but the reason why it's good for Odium is he's tired of fighting over this system. He wants to go out and defeat everyone else, but Teravangian also saw if he goes and fights them one-on-one, if he looks like he's a threat and isn't bound anymore, people will fight him more strongly.
Hmm.
So I think he's going to send warriors out but remain bound to Roshar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he'll have an army that can travel to other systems and fight his battles in kind of a proxy way.
And he's trying to have Dalinar lead that.
Yeah, he wants Dalinar to lead that.
Interesting. Okay.
Another interesting thing is like, yeah, maybe the contest doesn't matter because even if Dalinar wins, Roshar, you know, especially Alethkar and Herdaz are, you know, better off, not under Odium, and Dalinar is better off, but Odium's still going to just build an army with what he's got and still do, you know, send them off. Like he's still going to do what he wants to do. It's just like, if he wins the contest, then he has more of a, you know, more of an army.
Sure.
So
interesting.
Yeah. So like this, everything's building up to the contest, but I wonder if like this epigraph is kind of hinting that it's kind of a bait and switch. Like, actually there's more important events happening than the contest. It's just the contest is like a ticking clock almost.
Yeah. I do like the way you just put that, that the contest is more a symbol that it's the end of the war instead of like a big outcome of the end of the war.
Yeah. Cause hostilities will cease, lines that are, you know, whatever's in control, whatever each side controls, they keep, other than Alfkar and Haradaz, which are part of the contract. Right. I'm sure everyone else who doesn't live in Alfkar and Haradaz just love that Dalinar only negotiated for those two countries. But
yeah.
Need to go back and read Taravangian's contract with Odium at the end of Oathbringer, because that always sits in the back of my mind. I need to go reread that.
It's a contract with himself now?
Yes.
But one thing I remember about that, and I hope I'm not wrong about this, is part of the deal was protecting Kharbranth and all Kharbranthian descendants. And technically, Hasina and Kaladin are Kharbranthian descendants.
So yes, this is exact. So Kharbranth, anyone born in Kharbranth and their spouses, not their descendants.
Mm, yeah.
Not their descendants.
So explicitly not Kaladin and Oridan, but it does include Hasina and Lirin.
Gotcha. Okay, Kaladin's not safe from Odium then.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still wondering what's happened to his grandparents on either side. I don't know that we'll ever get the answer, but it's curious.
Now, when is Odium bound to that deal? Is he already bound to Taravangian's deal?
Yeah, so Rays signed a contract with Taravangian at the end of Oathbringer. And then obviously by the end of Rhythm of War, Taravangian has a contract with the Shard Odium, or maybe he had a contract with the Vessel Rays and therefore it's now void. I don't actually know the answer to that, but
I'm pretty sure he inherits the contracts. Like, that's why he had to do the contest.
Right.
So I guess my question is, like, beginning a Rhythm of War, like, Hasina was very close to being killed in battle, right?
Right.
If Bridge 4 hadn't shown up. So, like, is Odium, like, would he have protected Hasina and Lirin somehow? Or, like, is he only bound to, like, not go out of his way to destroy in general?
Right.
Or is it, like, every individual has to be, like, individually protected?
I don't know.
That's a great question.
Or maybe Hasina wasn't born in Kharbranth and this is all...
Well, she's a spouse, so...
But
Lirin wasn't born in Kharbranth.
Yeah, Lirin was born in Hearthstone.
Oh yeah, you're right. And
he meets Hasina in Kharbranth. So presumably Hasina is from Kharbranth, but that's an assumption. There's a jump there.
Maybe she's a herald.
I can just imagine Brandon this whole time laughing at us because she's not actually from Kharbranth.
But yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, something's going on in Shinovar is what I get out of chapter 11 at least.
Right. Yeah, I mean, based on these epigraphs, I'm now putting more weight on Shinovar than I am on the contest.
Yeah.
So. And there's also a lot of weight on Shallan's mission to get Ba'ad or Mishram freed from the spiritual realm.
Yeah.
Which we have a lot to talk about in that vein, I think.
We do.
Definitely.
But okay. Should we get through Kaladin's chapter first?
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about this Kaladin chapter.
Yeah.
On any day of the week, I am very excited to read new Kaladin and Sylphrena content. For whatever reason, this chapter, it goes off the wall, like, instantly in this chapter, and you're just reading paragraph after paragraph of just awkward conversation between Kaladin and Syl. And you, did you guys get the same vibe? Because halfway through this chapter, I was like, I'm not enjoying what I'm reading. This is really odd and weird.
It felt to be like typical Brandon trying to write silly. Like it, I know that you like, I think you like this chapter a lot, but in, it was Bands of Mourning, I think, when they go to that, they stay at that hotel and the,
they're messing with the hostess lady.
Like it felt similar vibe wise, where it's just like friends or, you know, whoever just messing with people, and it's kind of the way Sanderson writes that. That was mostly the vibe I got, but also like if you're a Cilladin shipper, you're loving this chapter, I think.
It's even more beyond that, because Syl's like actively trying to make Kaladin uncomfortable and then leaning into, you know, weird like nudity jokes with Kaladin. Mm-hmm. And I was rather taken aback by it. What do you think, Tim?
It made me uncomfortable. It was different than anything I'd read, than I remember reading, specifically between Kaladin and Syl. It's before, it's always felt like a bond of friendship. This felt more like flirting. Yeah.
I definitely wrote in my notes for myself, is Syl flirting with Kaladin, or is this simply just Syl being silly?
Yeah, I mean, is this banter between close friends, right, who share a bond, or is this like actual flirting happening here? Mm-hmm. I think it remains to be seen, but we seem to be asking this more and more every single episode. and it seems to be heading in some direction, but I could see that diverging, right?
Sure.
I was mostly uncomfortable because they were having this weird conversation just in the middle of a library.
Yes.
In front of other people. Like,
yeah,
I think it would be a little bit less uncomfortable if they were doing it in private.
Sure. Maybe
for me,
I don't know if that would really make a difference for me, but mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah.
So something else that we bring up every episode, it seems like, Syl picks up a pen and like signs her initial or something, or signs for the book.
Yeah, she writes a letter.
Once more, Syl is becoming or being pulled further into the physical realm. What are we, four out of five episodes we've brought this up now?
Yeah, because she's not in the prologue.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Or is she?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
No, no. No. It definitely has been a heavy theme of these first 11 chapters. And I'm sure it seems so huge to us because we're being, you know, drip fed this over several weeks, where if I got the book, I would have been through the first 10 chapters in an hour, and it wouldn't have felt like what in the world is going on.
I wonder if Syl's going to have a physical realm altercation with like an unmade when we get to Shinovar, because the unmade seem to be in the physical realm a decent amount from what we've seen from like the Heart of the Revel and the Midnight Mother in Yirithiru, et cetera, They seem to have a decent foothold in the physical realm, and Syl is leaning more that direction. So I'm wondering if there's going to be some sort of significant altercation between an unmade and Syl in the physical realm and what that would mean.
That's a great theory. It's definitely working towards something. I could see it being that. could even see it being something that, you know, her, I don't know, maybe them going back to the cognitive realm and her doing some literal fighting rather than glowing around.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. The thought that I always keep coming back to is, you know, Ishar is, they're heading towards Ishar, the guy who's been trying to bring Spren into the physical realm completely.
Yeah.
And like, this is, we just keep talking about that. Like, if we aren't heading towards that plot point, he definitely makes us think we are. And I think, like Tim said, we're reading this pretty slowly. So, you know, normally I would just glaze past a lot of this foreshadowing, but it feels really heavy-handed right now. A lot of the foreshadowing feels pretty obvious, but it's because it's like getting revealed the next chapter, right? But this is not going to get revealed for a while, I think. By the way, we're still only in day one. I'm very surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But... yeah, by the end of chapter 11, still day one.
Still day one, chapter 11, yeah.
I'm wondering if we're going to skip some days. If we're going to be in day one, and then day three, and then day four, and then day seven.
I think we're not going to get certain POVs on certain days.
Sure.
But I think we're hitting every day. I think that's going to be most of the book. I'm leaning towards that now. I didn't want it to be that. I think I even said so, like, when we were in the first episode. But, like, 11 chapters plus for day one. Unless day one is special, it looks like that's what we're going to be getting. Like, really fast-paced, lots happening every day.
Mm-hmm. Going back a second, when you mentioned Ishar, it made me think of when Syl's describing, like, Spren, who they are is what people think of them. So as we're seeing her think of herself more and more as human, I think that could make a quote transition to the physical realm perhaps possible, because there's a lot of anatomy that we don't think about, but is like completely necessary to actually live and survive as a physical human being rather than a Spren. So it could just be that, like, we got this awkward conversation so that later on when something like that happens, it's like, well, she can survive because she's been thinking about this.
Yeah, I mean, Kaladin's thinking about certain parts and whether she has them or not, such as a troll between her legs. But I'm thinking about, does she have lungs and a heart?
Exactly.
Right? Does she have a circulatory system? Does she have a nervous system?
Yeah.
Like, people aren't going to be thinking that Spren have that, so she probably doesn't.
I'm curious if we get to Shinovar and Syl eats something and it disappears, if that would be like a heavy indication that she's definitely in the physical realm at this point.
She eats something. What is there something special about Shinovar there, or are you just saying, like,
just as the story progresses? Yeah. Just as this moves forward, if she's, you know, I'm trying to think of something that would definitely indicate that she's becoming more human, and it would be eating something in my brain.
She and Nightblood share a sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the best theory so far. 10 out of 10.
I want to kind of, talking about her writing, I want to kind of transition to her saying that she's Kaladin's scribe. And there's a couple things to that. One is, we know that often wives are scribes. So Cilladin shippers, that's more evidence for you if you'd like it. But also, we never considered whether the epigraph writer could be Syl.
Oh,
interesting.
I'm not sure I'm convinced, or, you know, even could be a different Spren. But, like, we didn't even consider Spren at all in terms of who might be writing the epigraph. So I just thought I'd bring that up because I saw some discussion about it.
I guess we also could consider that Syl is the one writing to Dalinar on their span read. Maybe. If for whatever reason Zeth can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, Zeth is supposed to be doing it.
Right.
Syl can write one letter with a lot of effort. So
yeah,
maybe things
with progressed. A very light. Yeah, yeah.
She was using a feather pen Yeah. So it's because it's very light.
Yeah.
Kaladin not knowing words for things in this chapter also felt very strange. But
I did see your note that would Kaladin not really know what a library is? And I would lean into yes, because that's light-eyed stuff, and he doesn't have anything to do with light-eyed stuff. So I don't know. Would he probably know the word for library? Yes, but has he ever been in one? I doubt it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about how he was very much ready to study in Carbaranth, which has the very notable library of the Palinaeum.
True.
So, like, would it really never come up? Or is it more like, is it trying to be like he's so military brained now that, you know, he's going to call a library what did he call it?
The supply depot.
Supply depot for scribes. Yeah.
Yeah.
The scribe quartermaster is the librarian. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, but also, like, I don't know. There's stuff in this chapter that you have to really, I don't know, what's the word? You just have to buy into it, or yeah. It's just feels super wrong.
So, Sanderson humor usually plays well for me. It did not in this chapter. It felt very odd in this chapter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, Kaladin acting as a therapist felt pretty awkward in this too. It almost felt like Sanderson just like breaking the fourth wall and being like, don't be a bully, please. Just like adding that to the middle of this chapter. I think what he's trying to do is demonstrate that Kaladin is transitioning towards being, you know, Roshar's first therapist. But I don't know, it felt really forced to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was like I was waiting for that, and everyone stood up and applauded at the end of that speech.
Yeah. It certainly did its job, if its job was to remind me that Kaladin had his depression therapy group last book. And I had forgotten about that, and this did remind me of it. So if that's what the goal was, then it was successful. But I do agree, it seemed kind of forced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit awkward, a little bit like, all right, remember this. This is what I'm doing now. And then, okay, let's move on from this.
But the important part of this chapter, the actual content of this chapter, is Syl goes and gets the Way of Kings for Kaladin.
That's true.
As heir to the tower, maybe. What does this mean? Is Kaladin now following Noadon?
Ooh.
I think it's really symbolic. Probably not going to be helpful, other than, you know, perhaps like they show it to Ishar and he's like, oh yeah, I remember that guy, he was cool. I think it's mostly symbolic. And then also they threw in a little thing with typewriters from Carbaranth, or sorry, from Yakaved. And I was like, wait a second.
Is that what was being described? Because I didn't quite get what she was saying. I figured it was more like a printing press type technology.
Yeah, more printing press for sure. I just forgot the word. Happens sometimes.
So it's like typewriter's a bit of a leap, maybe on Scadrial. But it would be interesting if they had some sort of like Fabrial typewriter. That's hard to say for some reason. Like, you know how it seems like Scadrial is like Earth tech, right? It's tech you'd find on Earth. And then they sprinkle in a little magic. Whereas it seems like Roshar uses completely different ways to achieve the same kind of technology. And that leans much more heavily on you know, the captured Spren magic.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if maybe they do have something more akin to a typewriter. Like it's kind of like a leap forward from the span read, where like you can have a motion and then have it repeat that motion as many times as you want or something like that. That would be interesting. And then that would be a way of copying things multiple times. Or like, I don't know, I could see them having like one span read that's linked to 100 others And so you write the book once and you get 100 more copies of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's where my mind went. But
I was reading Sunlit Man last night, and Nomad thinks to him, or has an internal dialogue, that technology progression isn't the same on every planet, where he brings up this forest planet that he was at, where they had advanced mathematics but no concept of the wheel, because they didn't need it. So it's just an interesting idea of, as we move into Stormlight Era 2, what they produce and what they don't, and what they have to copy off Scadrial.
What's the phrase is something like, invention is the child of necessity.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. So, like, if you have the need drives invention. So it makes sense. It's like when I play Civilization, sometimes I like to just mess with the tech tree and be like, how can I learn rocketry before I learn pottery?
Right. Yeah. Like, how far down the sailing path can I go before I have to learn mining?
Yeah. It's like I can make modern warships, but I still don't know how to make the canoe.
Anything else from the Kaladin chapter? Alrighty. Shallan. Is this a word? Substantiation? Is that a word?
I mean, it comes from the word substance.
Sure.
So making substance. I mean, I could look.
It sounds convincing. And honestly, that's where all words come from.
The act of showing something to be true or of supporting a claim with facts.
Oh.
So it has to do with truth. Interesting.
Interesting.
That's awesome.
So like, if you just look at the word literally, it's like making something substance, but then the metaphorical meaning also kind of works. That's neat.
That is neat. Cause I read that word and I immediately thought, okay, she's giving substance to her illusion. But if you read that definition, she's giving definition to her illusion. She's giving reality to her illusion,
like truth to the lies.
Yeah
exactly, making the lie true. Reality is what she makes of it, right?
I
want to talk about this for a second. I love that Sanderson put in there that freaked her out. She said that last chapter, and then this chapter she's has a really hard time handling that. I really enjoyed that, because if you do take that to the conclusion of reality is whatever I make it to be, Shallan is going to go crazy in 3 chapters. Like it will get off the rails really, really fast. And the fact that she has a mental breakdown and like goes and hugs Adolin and makes sure he's real or whatever, I really did enjoy that, just to anchor Shallan a little bit, because Shallan chapters are getting really crazy really fast in this book.
Mm-hmm. Like she's like, how do I even know what's real anymore? Because anything could be an invention of my mind, and I don't even trust my own mind. And that's a really sad state to be in, to not know what is real and to worry that you're living in your own fantasy world.
It reminded me of that scene in Words of Radiance. First half of the book somewhere, she's talking to Pattern and she has a freak out moment of she's fabricated her brothers aren't real, and that this conversation she's having with her brothers via span read, she's making it up. And Pattern says, whoa, hold on, like this is reality, Shallan, you need to live in it, you're not fabricating this. And she's like, okay, and then they move on. So up until now, I feel like that scene had been kind of a one-off. I mean, she's been progressing down her road, I will say, as these books have gone on. But as far as being completely detached from reality, this seems to be the first time since then.
Yeah, so on the topic of Shallan's reality, there's a couple quotes I want to talk about. So there's an italicized kind of thought trust him, you can trust him. And it's not attributed to who is saying that in her head.
Yeah.
But later, I think this is Vale, because later there's this line, she had no idea what was going on and she was scared. In her core, she was still terrified. That, however, Vale whispered, is a step forward, in the same italics. Now, of course, any voice in your head is going to be italics, as Ba'ada Mishram was in italics. But I'm thinking you can kind of link these two together, where like Vale is still apart from her, a part of her, but apart from her as well. If that makes any sense. In that Vale is still like coming to the forefront and speaking to Shallan and grounding her, which is kind of a new role for Vale, isn't it?
I am curious what Vale's going to be doing moving forward, because what was it, chapter 4 of Wind and Truth, where Shallan was telling Pattern, Vale's still here, even though at the end of last book it seemed like Vale was a hurdle that we successfully passed, but no, she's still here. So yeah, I am very curious what Vale's role will be moving forward.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's very much the the scene in Star Wars where Luke is going and he hears Ben's voice, Luke, use the Force. Vale's gonna be more like that, this guiding help, kind of grounding her, more practical is how Vale has always been.
I can't help but wonder, though, if this first quote we're meant to think is Vale, but actually is a new emerging personality.
Or maybe
the opposite of formless, or what formless should have been, just something new entirely.
Formful.
Formful. What a good name.
Substance.
Substance.
I did want to talk a little bit about substantiation and that quote there that Abidi the Monarch says. You've learned substantiation. I thought your kind had forbidden that skill. Odium will need to know. And wanted to talk about why that would be forbidden. I've got some thoughts of my own, but I'd like to hear what you guys think first.
I have a crazy theory, so I'll go last.
Okay.
So if something is forbidden, so it's obviously an extremely useful ability. So in order for it to become forbidden, there has to be examples of something happening there where everyone's like, okay, yeah, we just can't touch this part of the magic system because of the consequences of what happened. And so it could be something along the lines of changing reality in this way is just too much, right? I don't know exactly how to put it, but like, yeah, just certain weapons or certain tactics are banned in a war because it's just immoral. So it could be that angle. It could be that what's happening to Shallan happens to all Radiants who use substantiation, which is they lose track of what's real and what's not, and they start thinking real is fake and fake is real, and they go insane from that. And now you have an insane Radiant who can substantiate. So it could be that. Or it could be related to how Ishar put limits on Radiant power. Or it was Honor and Ishar or whatever. Yeah. Because of like, hey, when you had those unleashed surges on Ashen, it destroyed the planet. So maybe substantiation is one of those factors of just, we have to limit the ability to use that. I like that third option, other than like, your kind had forgotten that skill. Now, your kind, is that humans? Is that Radiance? Is that Lightweavers? I wish Abidi had been more specific. Just go on a monologue about it. I'd be happy for that. But
yeah. Give us that villain monologue.
Of interest, though, Kalek knew it was possible and did not mention that it was forbidden. So,
true.
Yeah. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he wouldn't bring that up, and a fused would. Also, just one little tiny side bit before I give the floor to someone else, because I've noticed I talk a lot. But he does call him Odium, so he's not giving away that it's Taravangian now. I don't know what that he would ever call him, Raze or Taravangian, but I don't know, just a little thing that stuck out to me, like, oh, he called him Odium.
Like, yeah.
Does he know that Odium has changed? And if so, is he hiding that information?
Mm-hmm.
I think the earlier stuff is more interesting to talk about. But
that is interesting.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me jump in, Tim. I guess my theory is not as crazy as I was saying, because David, you said it. What if we had an offshoot of like insane Lightweavers that lived in their own little, I don't know, community and fabricated everything, and you just didn't go there? Like, you don't want to go talk to the Lightweavers. They're insane. So, yeah, it just makes it what this chapter made me think is going back to what we learned about cryptics to start with. They're attracted to lies. So, and there's that famous pattern quote where truths are the best lies if you alter something. Like, this is one of Pattern's first like actual phrases in the beginning of Words of Radiance, where Pattern says, Shallan asks Pattern as he's moving around the cabin, what is a truth or what is knowledge? And Pattern says lies or something like that. And fast forward all the way to here, if we're creating something from nothing, if we're creating something from light that has mass and you can interact with it, at what point is then lying, your fabrications, true? At what point are you actually creating a second person, a second personality standing next to you? Because up until now, you know, she's created Vale and Radiant in the room with her, but she specifically says she touches Radiant. So, mm-hmm. I don't know.
What you were just talking about really reminds me of WandaVision. I don't know if you've seen
the show. Yeah. Yeah, there's like a lot there.
She creates an entire town and family for herself, like, out of nothing. So, yeah, exactly what you were saying, Trevor, with what, like, a crazy Lightweaver might do. Just create their own reality and go live in it, because it's better than their real life.
Is Shalash our white Lightweaver? Or Herald?
No. Lightweaver Herald. Let's just check Coppermine, because I don't trust my memory. Oh, it was Shalash. You're correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, interesting. So I wonder if if Shalash were to get a hold of her Lightweaver powers, I wonder how crazy Shalash would be doing.
I mean, we know all the Heralds were insane in battle, in masteries of all of their surges, including probably a lot of the... What does Sanderson call those? Like, they're not harmonies, but like when you combine two surges and they have interesting effects.
Like, oh, there is a word for that. It'll come to be in a second here.
All I can think of is compounding.
Compounding is what Skadrians would call it, probably.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a different word for it in this case. But anyway, I wanted to kind of talk about, like, I want to compare the three Radiant Orders that overlap with the Lightweavers, because we've got the Truth Watchers who have illumination also. And they're using illumination to essentially better people, I think would probably be the best way to put it. Like, it combines with their healing abilities. We don't know much about them, but I feel like, you know, when we got a description of Adolin's hand being healed, I know that Renarin isn't actually a real Truth Watcher, but I feel like that's probably part of it, is like they show you the ideal version of yourself, and then that heals you to that ideal version. So
Yeah, there is a certain amount of that with like how you view yourself is how you heal.
Yeah. We see Shallan kind of using a bit of that as well, I think, with her drawings of people. But then on the other end, we've got the Elskallers, and they're kind of, their theme is like mastery of Shadesmar, right? So they can transport themselves to and from Shadesmar, is my understanding. Get fully in there on their own. And then also they have the soul casting, which is just when you're a mastery of Shadesmar, of course you're gonna be able to soul cast. So then we think about the Light Weavers and the fact that they're lies. These are the two surges that most overlap with lying, like creating fake images, illuminations, fake sounds, whatever they want to create there. And then also being able to change something into something else. Like, I feel like they kind of really like dig into the lying aspect of it. And that's kind of when you combine those two surges, you end up with something like substantiation and something like bending reality to those lies. So the lies become true. And it's the same thing with like her lying about her identity in the last set of chapters. Like there's something there where lies are super important to the magic system used by Lightweavers. I don't think that that's a coincidence.
I fully agree. There's so much of intent and mindset matters so much with this magic system that when everything you are is focused on that, it's almost limitless with what you can do.
I do really like this, that you brought this up, which made me reconsider the name Truth Watcher. If you're dealing in illumination and your other one is making things into anything else you want, you're going to lose touch of, like, where's your anchor, right? If both of your surges are manipulating reality into whatever you want, whereas the Truth Watchers have illumination and progression, which is healing. So that seems more of a reality-based power. So
have we put progression into too small of a box, just calling it it's the healing one?
I mean, that's what the copper mine says, is it's the healing one, but you're right. it could certainly be more than that. I'm sure it is.
I feel like progression is the one that's closest to cultivation, right?
Yeah, it's the Edge Dancer one, right? Edge Dancers have, whatever the other one is, then progression. The
friction one, whatever
it's called. Oh, yeah. I was about to call it adhesion, but that's not correct.
No, but the opposite. Yeah, I mean, progression has a name that implies much more than healing to me.
Right.
But we've never seen it used for anything other than healing. Unless there's something Lyft has been doing that's kind of hiding under the guise of actually being a progression power. Because Lyft does do a lot of social stuff. Almost along the lines of, I don't know. Would you be surprised if you found out Lyft had the ability to soothe and riot?
It's been a while since I've read a lot of Lyft stuff. Honestly, I just remember it as I care about you.
Yeah. That's definitely the oath, is caring about people who others don't care about.
Right.
I could see why Kaladin has Edge Dancer as the second, if he took that test, the online test, Windrunner, and then right under that Edge Dancer. But it's just a thought.
According to the epigraph author, that's certainly true.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the epigraph. All right, well, I guess we don't have much else to say about that other than, I don't know. Why is it called progression? I think this leads into talking about the beads. So one of the quotes I wanted to read about the beads is, it seemed eager to be helpful. This is Shallan in like that. How much has it changed since I am a stick?
Mm-hmm.
That now Shallan's like, ooh, it's eager to be helpful.
Well, and then in the previous chapter where Abidi was saying, oh, they hate us. And then mm-hmm. in this chapter, Shallan's like, oh, it likes me. Back to what I said earlier, Shallan chapters are getting really, really odd. Really yeah. odd. This whole moving her little room underneath the bottom of the beads around, like, what is going on?
The only way I can reconcile that is she is controlling a large number of beads from a distance without even having to touch them. Yeah. Because she said it was more like moving, like causing a current out of all the beads around them.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to put three options on the floor. And of course, you can also present options 4, 5, 6 if you want. But what is actually going on with her instantly finding the correct bead? Okay, option 1, tapping into fortune. So literally just being lucky, because we know she can tap into fortune. Option 2, she's lying to herself and she doesn't need a bead at all, but she's convincing herself she needs a bead. So like, oop, I'll just grab a random one. And oh, that was happened to be the correct one. I can now do the thing. Or number 3, she is literally soul casting the bead into the shape she wants so that she can then use it in Shadesmar. Those are what I thought of, and I have no idea which one's correct, or maybe it's a little bit of each, but
I'm very strongly behind the fortune train, and I think the evidence is that Ba'ed Omishram shows up, like when she's been drawing on fortune with her literal drawing. I think that's the evidence to show, okay, I'm pointing out as an author, this is so weird. Why does she have exactly what she needs? And here's why.
I also got that. I've gotten that several times, actually, in Wind and Truth already, where I felt like Brandon was pausing the story and saying, okay, I understand that this is weird. Like Shinovar, for example, where he kind of just pauses, talks to the reader and says, I know you don't know this yet, or I understand that was weird. Just hold on. And I don't know if I like that or dislike that. It doesn't bother me or anything, but I've felt that multiple times in Wind and Truth where it seems, or the Windrunners showing up in Lasting Integrity in a couple hours. It just seems like maybe Sanderson just needed to throw some stuff in there to explain it real quick and keep going. I don't know.
I accepted that behavior more in Tress than in a Stormlight book.
Yeah. Yeah, and in books, it's when the author needs to finally come up with the answers that it can be difficult for both the author and the reader to get through that.
I'm leaning towards option 2, that she's lying to herself. It gives me the same vibes as when she convinced herself she needed 10 heartbeats to summon Testament as a shard blade. She's like, I need the 10 heartbeats, so it's going to take the 10 heartbeats. So now it's like she said over and over again, I'm bad at the beads. I'm bad at the beads. I can't do it. I other people can do it, but I can't. So I need a bead in order to do this. But because the situation was so dire, she was able to kind of lie to herself and be like, oh, well, this bead will do it, right? And then, okay, I can accept that I found an open room bead. But now I found a bead that's a perfect open sphere. Like, okay, like what? Where is she that there's just a random big giant sphere hanging around, right? Like,
I do like what you just said here, because it was what, two Shallan chapters ago, where she was explicitly saying, I'm bad at the beads, I'm bad at the beads. What's his name? Vatha is mm-hmm. better at the beads than I am, and he's only been practicing. And then this whole chapter, she creates an entire room and it moves around like without her even thinking about it. She's just mm-hmm. manipulating the bead ocean to do exactly what she needs. So either she's way more powerful than she's giving herself credit for, or there's someone else helping her, whether that be fortune, whether that be cultivation. Like, you know, you could throw so many different theories out there. What it could be, Yasna, like on the other side helping her out or something. But
turns out she was born in Carbronth and Odium has to protect her.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I don't know. I do like that you highlighted this, because just two chapters ago she was saying over and over, I'm bad at the beads. You're right.
The evidence speaks otherwise, Shallan. And then I think another kind of running theme here is that she's terrified of her own powers and what she's able to do.
Absolutely.
So that goes into it. Like, if she convinces herself that she's not as good and can't do as much, then that makes it less scary.
Yeah.
If she knew how competent she actually was with these abilities, especially given her dual bond that she's constantly improving, like, she probably would, like, not want to use her powers at all because she's so scared of what she would do. And I think she's going to have to deal with that. I think that's going to be a plot line.
I wonder if it also has to do with Yasna explicitly telling her to not touch it. So that's made her afraid of it more.
Could be.
Because yeah, you know, back in the Way of Kings or Beginning Words of Radiance or whatever, Yasna tells her, don't mess with this until you have a bunch of Stormlight, till I'm with you, et cetera, et cetera. Then Yasna dies. So she doesn't touch it for a book and a half, two books. Yeah. So.
And I'm remembering some throwaway line that she was soul casting as a kid.
Right.
I don't remember where that was, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I remember that too.
Bought in a Mishram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Shows up on like this, the wall of this room that she's made. This creepy female in face crown, whatever. We saw the illustration earlier. And then Adolin walks over and like hacks at it with a sword.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
So one thing I wanted to know. So this quote, I'm just going to read the whole thing. I will kill you. I will burn everything you love. I will exact vengeance in a river of blood. I will rampage across this world until not a single human remains drawing breath. Betrayers, thieves, monsters. I will send you back to the flames from whence you. As soon as I read this, in my mind, this is her ranting and raving as they're capturing her into the gemstone.
Mm.
And that's why it cuts off.
Okay.
It's in italics. And I know we've had font discussions before when the prologue released 2 years ago, but did Adolin hear this? I was unclear. Adolin certainly attacks the giant face, but you'd attack a giant face even if you didn't hear it talking. So
I'll go back to your original question in a second, but I really enjoyed Adolin just running over and like hacking at this with a sword, because this entire fight, Adolin is, you know, been really trying to help and really cannot. He's just laying at the bottom of the beat ocean waiting for Shallan to come save him. And he finally sees something that he can go hit with a sword. So he's like, I got it. And he goes and smacks the wall with his
sword. 7-pound great sword.
Yep. Finally, I can do something. I would venture no, that this was a Ba'at Yad HaMishram directly to Shallan moment. But obviously, as we've seen these last couple of weeks, we'll probably get this answered next week. So yeah, Adolin will be like, oh, how about that voice? So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think he necessarily didn't hear it, but it does explicitly say, I just double checked, that the voice is in her mind.
But so, then also Adolin's reacting to it.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
So I don't trust Shallan narrator at all.
Wise.
Yeah.
I don't trust a word Shallan narrator says, to be honest.
Yeah. But this does make me wonder, though, like, okay, we need to release her for the health of Roshar, but is it really a good idea?
Maybe she's calmed down by now. That's why I thought this was like her just being like, how dare you try to betray me and trap me like this, right?
Yeah.
And it was a bad idea. So maybe she'll have her own trial against humanity and Adolin can represent them there too.
I've always been under the assumption that Ba'at Yad HaMishram would be one of the more reasonable of the unmade, where she'd be more aligned with maybe cultivation and this, like the singers of old, than Odium. After reading this, I'm not sure if that holds up. She seems rather upset.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be upset too if I was getting captured into a gemstone that and to be put there forever and shoved into the spiritual realm. So
for sure. I mean, I completely understand it, but I didn't think this was the route. I didn't think Ba'at Yad HaMishram would be an overt antagonist. Sanderson hasn't really been doing that since, or besides Odium.
I think Ba'at Yad HaMishram has onion layers.
Sure.
We're seeing one moment where she's particularly angry and afraid. So I would like to posit the question, though, is Ba'ed Omishram more of an antagonist this book than Odium is?
Interesting. I made a poll on the following note on YouTube channel, like maybe a year ago, of what the biggest antagonist would be in Stormlight 5. And I put Marais, I put Thaidakar, I put Odium, I put a fourth one. It wasn't Ba'ed Omishram, but maybe I should have, because you're right. Ba'ed Omishram, I mean, there's no polite way to put it other than, I will rampage across this world until not a single human remains drawing breath. That's pretty vivid.
Too bad the B in breath wasn't capitalized. That would have spawned like a half an hour conversation just from that.
Drawing breath.
Yeah, that definitely.
And Shallan draw breath.
Before our conversation tonight, I would have said, well, of course, Odium is the antagonist, but it seems like after what we've been talking about, maybe the contest of champions doesn't really matter that much. It's just that a deal was struck and the outcome isn't, like, it's not the end of the world, literally, either way. And then Ba'ed Omishram seems like, at least based off of just one quote, that she would be willing to break that.
Right. Like, based off this quote and what we talked about with the contest, Odium is not seeking to wipe out the humans. Ba'ed Omishram absolutely is, if she still, yeah, you know, is in this headspace. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if Ba'ed Omishram will eventually be defeated by anti-light of some kind, or unmade via anti-light, or we need some kind of conclusion to what the unmade are and what it means that they were unmade. And like, there was explicit references to this by Ja and Not in Oathbringer, if I recall. And we never really learned more after that. So I'm getting the vibes that this book is about the unmade and is going to explain a lot about the unmade.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am too. I was thinking about this the other day. How many unmade are in Oathbringer and how many unmade are not in Rhythm of War? We see like 6 in Oathbringer and we see 2 in Rhythm of War, which is kind of odd to think about.
Yeah.
And then we know there was an unmade messing with Shallan in her childhood.
Has that been confirmed?
Well, Behoid basically said it in her flashback. That's enough confirmation for me. I don't think there's additional confirmation, but
sure. Plenty of people have, you know, theorized on which one or, you know, all that, but I'm not sure if that was confirmed or not.
Yeah. I mean, it could be Hoid being more cryptic than I think he's being, but, I mean, there's a reason he bonded a cryptic, but
yeah, for sure.
I mean, It is the prevailing theory, but it's one of those theories that I'm like, if that's wrong, I'll be surprised/disappointed. But
yeah.
I think it's the Blackfisher personally, but I don't know.
What is the Grand Knell?
Ooh.
I wanted to talk about this.
I saw this term and I read it and I thought to myself, new terms? In the fifth book, I assumed we were getting, you know, delving into more questions about what we already knew. I did not think we'd be getting a new term.
Do you know what Knell means?
I just looked it up.
What is it?
It's the sound of a bell, especially when run solemnly for the death or a funeral. So have you heard the phrase death knell?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So, first of all, the compass points towards the Grand Knell, and my understanding is it only works in Shadesmar. We could debate that, or we could just agree to that. But it said that the exact quote is, this device points to something far in the distance, something the sibling called the Grand Knell, source of the current, the death of a god. So which god's death? Another poll for you guys. And then I'll justify what I think it is.
It's honor. Gotta be, it's got to be honor. But go ahead and with your multiple choice if you had some.
All right. Honor, Aedonalsium, or ambition?
I thought maybe Aedonalsium on when I was thinking about it on my own. But I read a little bit more of your argument. I think we'll be talking about. What about you, Trevor?
It's got to be honor. And the grand knell shattered the plains with cymatics. There was a toll, a bell toll, bong, and it shattered the plains.
So I think they would have figured out if it pointed towards the shattered plains, though.
Maybe.
It says it points to a distant point not to use point again, but if you think about it, like this is a wild tangent, but the sun's rays coming to the earth, we can basically just model that as all of the sun's rays being parallel to each other.
Sure.
Because even though they're not parallel, the sun is so far away that the angle is indistinguishable. It may as well be parallel.
Right.
So if this compass, no matter where you are on Roshar Shadesmar, always points in the same direction, it has to be pointing to another world or some point in the distance that isn't on Roshar. It has to be far enough away that it feels like it's wherever you are in Roshar, from that point to the death knell feels like a parallel line.
Sure.
So in that case, I would think it's either Yolen, where they killed Aedonalsium, or where ambition was shattered. And I have some evidence towards ambition. So Rhythm of War, Epigraph 27. That said, the most worrying thing I discovered in this was the wound upon the spiritual realm, where ambition, mercy, and odium clashed, and ambition was destroyed. The effects on the planet Threnody have been disturbing.
Hmm.
And then there's two WBs. We're allowed to talk about Word of Brandon's?
Yeah.
Okay. So just two little snippets of quotes from two different WBs. Suffice it to say that this specific splintering has had far-reaching effects. That's on ambition. And then also, let's just say that the things that happened with ambition have had ramifications across many places in the Cosmere. So,
both those.
Yeah, the death knell, the grand knell. I was with you, Tim, until I did more reading on this, that Aedonalsium, right? Or maybe honor. But I think it's ambition. I think that whatever happened to ambition, it wounded the spiritual realm. Like, that battle had something going on that did not happen when honor died. I think Odium was experimenting with different ways of killing shards, and ambition was the first.
Right.
And he's like, okay, I'm not doing it that way again. And then he went to Cell and killed Devotion and Dominion, and he's like, well, what if I shove him into the cognitive realm? It's like, oh, I can't do that again. Right, like, then honor after that. So he's learning how to kill without having these effects. But
so I wonder if the speed at which the death happens matters, because obviously we saw Ruin and Preservation, or more accurately just Preservation, die slowly over, you know, however many years, and it seemed to be a pretty seamless event, all things considered. And I think the same thing happens to Honor, right? Honor knows he's dying for a long time, and you know, sets up this plan with Dawn Shards and all that, blah blah blah. But whereas, you know, what you're talking about, ambition might have been, you know, an actual physical battle in either the cognitive realm, spiritual realm, physical realm, whatever, and there was a death event. So yeah, I do like what you have here.
Yeah, I think it's solid. I really like the stuff with ambition, and the quotes, the epigraph, the Words of Brandon. I think that's really solid evidence. I was a little distracted because I remembered a little bit earlier in chapter 11, when Shallan is thinking about that wow, it's, you know, really convenient that she found the right bead. And then there's a section that says Shallan, a voice said in her mind, and then she like snaps back to the present and realizes, okay, Adolin needs help. And in my notes, I was thinking, you know, maybe that's the wind, and maybe the wind is directing the beads in that direction. I know it's jumping back a couple conversations. Now, as I read it, I think maybe it is just Vale trying to get her to not think about that. But what do you think of the wind being involved here?
I have a crazy theory. So if Trevor, you want to talk about the wind, you can do that first.
I think it's feasible, but I mean, I have another tangent as well. So go ahead, David, and then...
Presumably, Shallan makes it into the spiritual realm later in this book.
Right.
Could this be a Harry Potter time turner thing? Where Shallan is yelling at herself through the spiritual realm?
No. I'm going to say no, because I trust Brandon and him telling us that explicit time travel to the past is not a thing. However, obviously we've seen some very odd things in the spiritual realm within the last five chapters of Rhythm of War and the first 10 chapters of Wind and Truth. So I want to say no. I hope it's not that. It's possible, though.
It definitely fits with that. And makes me think immediately of Interstellar. If I didn't know of the word of Brandon, I would give it a lot more of a possibility.
Yeah, I wonder if it's kind of a, we're not going to do backwards time travel, but spiritual realm will be the spiritual realm. And if Shallan is tapping into the spiritual realm, she should be able to see herself in there.
Sure.
Because the spiritual realm has no concept of time. Which still blows my mind. Like, how does that even work? No space or time. But
I wonder if it's both. I wonder if Vale is still hanging around in the spiritual realm, and Vale is speaking to Shallan via this. So I wonder if it could be both.
So back to my controversial spiritual shadow. I didn't realize it would be so controversial on Discord, but
yeah.
My controversial spiritual shadow theory of, could Vale be a spiritual shadow now? Because Shallan still has a connection with her. And so then when she taps into the spiritual realm, she can hear Vale.
Maybe.
But it could be a much, much simpler explanation of Vale integrated, but is still there. Right.
Right.
But like, I feel like there's key moments where she's getting like important advice in her head, like that turns things around. And it felt very Harry Potter, what is it, the third movie to right. me, third book slash mm-hmm. movie, where
sure.
it's like Harry's like, oh, my dad saved me, but it was himself saving himself, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. I like to repeat myself, I desperately hope it's not that, because specifically in Harry Potter, they set all that up and then deliberately don't touch it for the next four books. And that's right. That's a whole thing in the Harry, like I'm not a big Harry Potter fan, but I know there's a lot of people that are really upset about that, because there are so many of these issues that could be solved if you just went back to your time turner. And you know, J.K. Rowling doesn't do that. So
no, it should only be used to take extra classes in a semester.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there is something to be said about, and it's not limited to Harry Potter, and I don't want to right. specifically talk about Harry Potter here. But there is the form of time travel where you can't actually change anything because the time travel already happened. Right. So it's like a self-causality type time travel, as opposed to time travel that like splits off new realities, which is also pretty common. I don't think Sanderson would do that. Mm-hmm. I also am leaning towards Sanderson also wouldn't do the closed loop version of time travel. But I think if he were to pick between the two, he'd pick loop. And if we're exploring the spiritual realm in this book, which we definitely are, and learning more about it, time is not a factor. Like I was just talking about how the voice she heard from Bada Mishram could have been from the past.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Because being separate from time is very different from time traveling.
Right.
Even if it feels very much the same right now.
I mean, that's essentially what we did with Tien in the last book, right? We tapped in with Tien in our current timeline as if he were still alive, but he's not. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Timey-wimey stuff.
Right.
As Doctor Who would say. Are we ready to move on to another topic? Or?
Yeah. I want to mention the Rashadium briefly, because there's a... So the whole music spread, I think we talked about this last episode or maybe the episode previous, but there are music spren and they're kind of overlapped with Gallant, and Gallant is flying around this beat ocean while we're fighting. This was a very odd scene, to be honest, but Gallant is just having the time of his life. And there's this other music spren who comes and like hangs out with Adolin, and I thought it like obviously this is Sureblood, right? Like there's no way this is not Sureblood. So that why was that not spelled out for us? Of like, oh, this is Sureblood's music spren. Like that's really cool. Well, why was that not spelled out for us?
I think Adolin knows it was Sureblood. I think Shallan doesn't care about these damn horses.
That's fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, well, I think we're going to hear from Adolin later. I can't believe I saw Sureblood Spren, and Shallan will be like, sure who?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he hasn't had time to process it at all. So it'll come with time.
He was busy being extraordinarily competent.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, I had to mute myself because I was just cackling back here, imagining a movie version where you've got, you know, this cut of intense fight scene, and then you zoom over, like pan over to the horse, and you've got the 90s song, Having the Time of Your Life.
Yeah. You have this like intense monologue sequence between Abidi and Shallan, and Shallan's like trying to come to grip with her fear. And then Gallant's just like in the background doing nothing.
Oh, yeah.
So I believe I can fly.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's so good. I love the Rashadian thing. And I like that we got the answer of there is more going on. Yes, we knew it, but now it's spelled out. Feels good.
Who had Secret Singer Army on their bingo board for day one of Wind and Truth? This seemed so random. They are headed to this perpendicular or the Oath Gate, and they didn't bother checking this Oath Gate ahead of time, or you know, they didn't screen this. There's an entire Navy fleet hanging out by this Oath Gate of this Secret Singer force who's about to attack, and that's how this chapter ends. Basically, I was kind of miffed by this one.
It said they were planning it for months. How did they know that they'd be able to get through the Azamir gate when it just opened? Like, they literally just talked about how, like, now that Navani has bonded the sibling, now the Oathgate Spren are willing to allow travel to Cognitive Realm and back. That just happened. And yet they've been planning this invasion for months and been traveling in secret.
And it said they traveled from... It explicitly says they didn't use the Oath Gate. Like, it's not like they jumped through an Oath Gate and came here. They came from the Horn Eater Peaks, which I'll talk about here in a second, to Azamir to block them off or to invade. What?
So, we know that Odium, when he was trying to tie down forces attacking in a physical realm, a large part of that was just a distraction. One, we thought it was only a distraction for when they invaded the tower, but it seems like he had multiple things going on, and this is one of those. But in Oathbreaker, wasn't he bringing people through the spren of the Oathgate directly into the physical realm, or was it only coming through his spren?
Huh? I don't really know what you're referencing. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know.
In Oathbringer, at the end at Thalen City, our heroes Kaladin and the rest of them, they get to the Oathgate, and there are a bunch of, is it fused there or spren?
Void spren.
It's void spren. Yeah.
Specifically spren, not like physical beings.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, there were the heavenly ones that were attacking them, but that was separate. And obviously Kaladin and co got through Dalinar's perpendicularity. But I think that was representation of Odium had gathered spren to Thalen City, because you need them for things like the big rock people. What are they called?
Thunderclasts
and they also, all those spren like inhabited the army, I think.
Yeah.
The Amram's army.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. So there is a singer force there, but it's in the physical realm. Venli's a part of it. And yes, there's a bunch of void spren waiting to bond Amram's army. But yeah, they
So clearly this attack was Raze's idea, not Taravangian's idea, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Could this army be completely unaware that they have new leadership?
I was wondering this earlier in the episode when you brought this up. How many of the fused, how many of the singers know about Todium? Presumably zero?
I'm pretty sure it's zero.
L knows.
Does he? I don't remember the L scene at the end.
The epigraph of Rhythm of War, right? Not epigraph, sorry, the epilogue. He specifically says something about there being a new Odium. I could bring up my Kindle real quick and get the quote if you want.
There is that scene at the end. Yeah, you are right. There's a scene at the end where L is talking to the pursuer. I just don't remember that scene very well.
It's not the epilogue. Sorry, epilogue is Hoid.
Dirty Tricks.
But there is definitely a chapter with L.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's the second to last chapter of the book.
Testament? Ooh, I'm scrolling through Rhythm of War. Venli says the words. And it's your words, Venli, a distant female in voice said in her mind, are now accepted.
Oh, goodness. Is she a will shaper?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, we don't need to.
We don't need to get into that.
Is this Baal Demishram is my question. But because we've had a female voice accepting lifts. Oaths as well,
right?
Yeah, I would think cultivation more likely, but anyway, for the Azamir strike force, I think Race had something more planned here. He obviously had a way that he knew he could get them in, whether it's them going further and going all the way to Shinovar, something like that. It didn't bother me that we had another experience like this where, oh no, they're going to the same place, because they weren't camped out there. It was like they're still traveling in the same direction. So I just took it as mere coincidence, helpful. I think Kaladin is going to be really tempted to go and save them if they're not able to get out there and somehow word gets through.
Yeah, because Kaladin and Zeth are on their way to the Oathgate, on their way to Shinovar, right?
Yeah.
So my question, what I think is going to happen, actually, rather than a question, is they're rushing to get to Azamir before this force. I think they're just going to lock the gate, and the force is going to be stranded in the cognitive realm. Which is kind of why I asked the question of how did they think they were going to get from the cognitive realm to the physical realm.
Sure.
Yeah.
Were they depending on the Oathgate somehow being unlocked at that point? Do they have a way to maybe unmake the guardians of the Oathgates?
Maybe. I mean,
yeah.
Wait, didn't they? No, hold on. Didn't they jump through an Oathgate at the end of Oathbringer to attack Urethiru?
No, they used the Oathgates from physical realm to physical realm.
You're right. You're right.
Which were already open.
Yeah.
They snuck a fort. They really like those dirty, sneaky tactics, don't they?
They do. What? Okay. Yeah. Apparently, this force came from the Horn Eater Peaks. What is going on in the Horn Eater Peaks?
The same stuff that's going on in Shinovar.
I need to know, like, what is going on? Cultivation, what are you doing? Letting, you know, 100 chips worth of singers through your oath gate or through your perpendicularity.
But also, does this mean that the Horn Eater Peaks were invaded by a giant force?
Right.
A couple months ago? And around the same time that Rock was heading back there?
Right.
Is he heading back there and he's going to find not what he thinks he's like finding?
About this, or maybe just before. About the same time that the tower fell, the Horn Eater Peaks fell.
Maybe, yeah. And it's like, I could see the plot line of Horn Eater being he gets there and they forgive him because of how much he helps in the fight against, like, if he has to fend off invaders to the Horn Eater Peaks, like, right now he's like, I'm not supposed to be a warrior. I shouldn't be fighting. Like, that's sort of his internal conflict. So it could focus on that, and then he gets over that by defending his homeland. Or it could be he arrives too late, and he gets there, and it's already been occupied by the singers. And that could be a completely separate plot line.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or he arrives just in time to evacuate, and like they all jump through the perpendicularity first, and then the singers take over.
There's a lot of possibilities depending on timing, so I'm really interested. But the fact that it's pretty clear that this force came from the Horn Eater Peaks a few months ago, like, that could easily timeline line up with when Rock starts heading towards the Horn Eater Peaks.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
That was a lot. Anything else?
The last thing I want to talk about is the drawing at the end. And some of the words there, specifically, it says, Notam says that not all Spren are imagined by men. And then, like true Spren, no two of these appear to be the same. It's a drawing of the music Spren or the horses. And then, you know, Adolin seems to have a special connection with this one. It's cool. And I wonder if there's more to it, or if it's just a nod to, like, where did these Spren come from? It seems like they're almost, quote, true Spren, but not quite. But they definitely have something there. I wonder if that's going to be a big plot point, or if it's just a minor fun thing for the horse people in the audience.
Yeah, that is one of them. The implication is that the horse Spren are created by the thoughts of horses.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Two are exactly the same. So, like, yeah, they're like a radiant Spren created by horses, which we almost kind of talked about that last episode, I think.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Adolin knew that was Sureblood. Like, if he didn't, then he's more of an idiot than I thought.
Yeah, definitely.
Shallan just didn't realize. But the other thing I noticed is Ba'ud Amishram does not make an appearance in this picture.
True.
I was totally expecting there to be a little Ba'ud Amishram face in, like, one of the hiding around one of the corners or something. Maybe there is one hidden. We just haven't seen
it. Yeah, that's now what I'm looking for. I'm like, is there something in Adolin's clothes that I'm not seeing or something?
Because she said she was, like, hiding the face at, like, in various places.
Yeah.
But I don't see it. These drawings are really cool, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. If you listen to these without... Did you guys see that they put the audio on the website? Like, all the way to the bottom?
Did.
I didn't, I didn't realize that till last week.
I think last week is the first time they did it, and then they retroactively added it to the previous ones.
Oh, okay. So I'm not crazy.
No, you're not crazy.
Well, that's a separate issue.
Okay.
You may or may not be crazy, but if you are, it's not for this reason.
Let's close it here, and we can reconvene next week with whatever we get from Brandon Sanderson. Thanks for joining me, Tim and David.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.